Welcome to episode 22 of Messing About in Ships, May 8th, 2008. This week we bring you a special episode about the Sean Seymour casualty and EPIRBS, our internet ports of call, and as usual, some pod-safe music.
Welcome to Messing About in Ships, Maritime Podcast, episode number 22. I'm Captain John Conrad from gcaptain.com, and my podcasting partner is Peter Mello from seafever.org. Good evening, Peter. How are you?
I'm good, John. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Good, good. What's new at over at gcaptain?
Oh, not too much. We just had our first birthday, so we celebrated with a little contest, gave away some iPods and stuff. We also hit 1 million page views. So,
wow, congratulations. Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah, pretty neat.
Very cool. We missed you last week.
Yeah, you guys did fine without me. I listened to the podcast. It was really good. So,
glad you enjoyed it. I thought Christian did a great job. I thought enjoyed hearing what he's going through, and look forward to hearing about more of it in the future, reading his blog, and who knows, maybe he'll get into podcasting. Maybe we can get him here occasionally to tell us what's happening over there.
That'd be good.
So you have any other news items?
No, that's it for this week.
The only thing I got is our friend Nick at Big Ocean's Tiny Boat. Remember him?
Mm-hmm.
Well, he finally made it across the Atlantic. It took him 30 days, but he's in Barbados, and he has a couple blog posts recently about what the trip was like across the Atlantic in a very tiny boat, and I think they're worth a read. It did look like a pretty miserable experience, but he was happy to make it to Barbados, and he seems to be actually fired up about the rest of the voyage, so check it out. He safely made it, though. We were worried about him for a bit.
Yeah, 30 days isn't bad in such a small vessel.
Yeah, so. I think it's like 23-foot or 26-foot boat. So, and
wow.
He got banged around pretty good. You got to definitely read. He kept a daily diary, and it seemed like he actually had to spend a lot of time on the cabin sole because he was getting tossed out of his berth. That's how rough it was. So, anyway, check it out. We'll have a link in the show notes about that. We had a couple listener comments this week, too. Christian Conover, we got a track back from him. He wrote on his blog, "This past week I talked with Peter Mello over Skype for a feature on Messing About in Ships podcast, which he and Captain John Conrad co-host. It ended up being more than a half hour and is included in full in the latest MAIS podcast episode." And he gives a link to it. So that was nice. He gave us a little track back, a little link love there. And then just on that note with Christian, actually, he last week was also a CG blog find on the unofficial Coast Guard blog, which we're going to talk about a little bit later. But so anyway, he's getting a lot of coverage out there, deservedly. I think he's doing some cool things. Then we got another comment from Larry Rubin, and it's a little bit lengthy, but I think it's worth reading. It says, "I would like to expand on comments made in podcast number 20 regarding background investigations. I have some knowledge in this field as I am a former investigator for the U.S. Office of Personnel Management. Background investigations for security clearances, especially those done for the MSC for chief mate and master, are exhaustive. All the facts provided or statements made by the applicant are checked and verified, either by computer or in person by a field inspector. Previous investigations are kept on file and are cross-checked against the current submissions for any variations. If there are any issues in your past, it is better to be up front and admit them. You will be given an opportunity to explain and admit you have learned from your past and will not repeat your transgressions. If you do not admit the issues and they are uncovered during the investigation, it can be seen as an intentional act of deception or lying. Then the perception of the applicant changes from someone who has had a problem in the past that may have a reasonable explanation to someone who is now a liar and is difficult to explain a lie. If the applicant is lying about one thing, what else are they lying about? The entire application is now in question." So that was from Larry Rubin, and he submitted that on May 5th. I think that kind of falls along the lines of what I was presenting in the last two podcasts ago about the whole issue about making sure you fill out full disclosure on applications for your license and any kind of maritime credentials.
Yeah, it's like when the Coast Guard comes aboard your vessel for the annual inspection, you want to make sure you're not only is the safety equipment in top-notch order, but that the decks are clean, that there's fresh paint, or at least it looks as decent as it can for a working ship. Because if they start to find a dirty ship or real visual problems, even the small stuff, then they're going to dig more into that area, and they'll usually find something. So if you're honest and straightforward up front, even if there's a bad area of the ship, if you just tell them, hey, we were working in this area, we were just doing a project, they're real understanding.
Absolutely. Honesty is the best policy, right? Full disclosure. So I think that's great advice. We had one listener chart himself a couple weeks ago, I think, actually. I forgot it last week. T. Stanley, and it looks like he's in Des Moines, Iowa. So thank you for listening, and thanks for putting yourself down on the chart. This week we're doing something a little different. John, you want to talk about what's coming up?
Yeah, we've chronicled it here on this podcast, episode number 12, The Rescue of the Sean Seymour 2. This is a sailboat that hit some really heavy weather in the North Atlantic and was rescued by the Coast Guard. The owner of the vessel, Captain Gene, continues to be really concerned about a problem he had with his EPIRB. One EPIRB, his backup EPIRB worked, but his newer EPIRB sent out the message saying he was the wrong boat. So the Coast Guard called up the owner of the wrong boat who was laying in bed and probably said, oh, I'm okay. And the rescue was delayed, and Gene has continued issues with us and wanted us to bring up the importance of EPIRB. So Rob and I talk about it a little bit in this upcoming segment here. Welcome to this special segment of Messing About on Ships Maritime Podcast. Today we're going to be talking about EPIRBs and some problems that have been uncovered with them. The specific story we are going to discuss concerns the sailing vessel Sean Seymour II, which a year ago needed to be rescued from the waters of the North Atlantic. They had some EPIRB failures. We have actually discussed, longtime listeners of this podcast know we have discussed this issue before. In episode 12, we talked to the helicopter rescue crew who performed the rescue of the Sean Seymour II. Today's episode is going to be discussing the EPIRBs. For those who are not familiar outside the maritime industry, EPIRB is an emergency position indicating radio beacon. These are transmit your position via satellite to a search and rescue station. And they are either manually launched or mounted on a hydrostatic release so that when a ship sinks, they're automatically deployed. On the Sean Seymour II, they had problems with their EPIRB. I'm going to now read the final log entry of the Sean Seymour II, which can be found at the captain of the vessel's personal blog site, artcprovidence.blogharbor.com. Okay, let me read it. After the knockdown, I knew there was already structural damage and that we had lost control of the vessel. I pulled the GPIRB, which is a GPS-enabled EPIRB, but I suspect that the old EPIRB from 1996 might have been automatically launched first. I kept this unit as a redundancy latched in its housing on the port side of the hard dodger. It may have ejected upon the first knockdown as Coast Guard authorities questioned relatives with this vessel name versus the Sean Seymour II.
Herein lies a question that needs to be answered. Hopefully it will be in light of the U.S. Coast Guard report. So with me today is Rob Stormer. He's a regular contributor to this podcast, does the weather segment with us. Welcome, Rob. How are you doing today?
Hey, John. Well, very well. Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we're glad to have you. Can you give our listeners a little bit of your background?
A little bit of my background. Let's see. I guess besides being one tree short of a hammock, I've been a senior master salver now for, good 30 years or 25 years. Prior to that, I was a chief engineer, Santa Fe Island, on board U.S. flag container ships. My background is pretty much extensive in the salvage business, handling ship casualties pretty much all over the planet. I guess to date, probably have somewhere around, 4,000 casualties under me. I think I've ridden around enough to get ready to retire.
That's an impressive resume. So if a ship's in danger, they're going to activate their EPIRB, and the Coast Guard or local authorities will do any immediate rescue personnel. And then after that happens, you're the guy they call, huh?
Well, as they say, normally it doesn't matter what salvage company is deployed. The salvagers are normally the guys running on board ship while everybody else is running off. Normally what will happen is once the vessel reports a major casualty, depending upon the casualty, of course, rescue is, or SAR operations are immediately launched. Regulatory agencies are brought in. And then, of course, depending upon the vessel or the maritime company involved, her relationship with salvagers, they could either go to the Lloyd's open form or they'll call in their salver, and the salver immediately responds. Again, depending upon the casualty, that could be anywhere to vessels on the ground, or salvage tugs being pulled in, launching of divers, marine firefighters. Depends upon the what the casualty actually is. If it's engine room, problem with machinery or engine room damage, they could even bring in the salvage engineers to assist. It's a pretty broad spectrum of operations that salvagers get involved in on board ship during a crisis. Normally they'll work within the unified command system of that particular authority, if it's the United States or whether it's a governmental agency abroad. They are part of that command system that are working in unison with regulatory authorities and the ship owner themselves. But most of the times they're representing the ship owner or attempting to salvage the vessel itself.
So that's what the Lloyd's agreement is. You have to have an agreement with the ship owner to say, okay, we want the ship to be saved, and we give you the authority to do what you need to do, right?
Yeah, in basics, they call it the no cure, no pay deal. You've got to be able to do what you say you've got to be able to do, and be able to respond to the crisis at hand. The industry is a small industry. There are only very few major salvage companies out there that have the capabilities of responding to a major incident. The Lloyd's Open Form is one avenue that ship owners and salvagers have. There are several other avenues that both the ship owner and the salver have as a relationship. Of course, in the United States, underneath the Oil Pollution Act of 1990. There are, even stricter requirements for spill responders and salvors and ship owners. Again, it depends upon what authority you're running into a problem with or where exactly you are at the time. And what the vessel, what the vessel master or ship owner, which direction they want to go.
Interesting. And I take it from the casualty list of late, business is good for you guys recently, huh?
Well, I got to tell you, it's amazing. It's been one heck of a start of a year. I mean, if you look at the casualty reports, there has been an increase of casualties. The first start of the year, a lot of it is due to heavy weather, dramatic heavy weather. A lot of it's due to, the industry problems of inexperienced crews and ship officers, getting themselves into predicaments and either overreacting or underreacting to the incident. It continually amazes people, including myself, on how some of these ships get into the positions they're in. Again, as you know, it's not like you're driving a car. You just don't step on the brake and have the ship stop. Depending upon the type of vessel and her size, stopping these creatures when you're in a collision getting into a potential collision is not easy. And even maneuvering them, as you know, is it's not like driving a car, as most people know. You just don't turn the wheel and watch her move. She takes time, and that's why one of the critical factors is fatigue. And when you overdo a crew or a bridge, as they say in the industry, ship happens. But it's amazing on how some of these collisions can occur and how ships fail. There's a few of them. I think one of the most highly publicized. Recently has been the River Dance out in Blackpool, England. I'm still impressed that they decided to sail that ferry in a force 9 gale. And today she's still sitting along on her side on the beach at Blackpool. So luckily MCA did a heck of a job in the rescue, and the salvors now are pulling their hair out trying to figure out what to do with that tourist attraction that's sitting on that beach right now.
Yeah, the other impressive, we got a lot of page views on gcaptain.com. The Pasha Bulker running up at a beach. There's a huge bulk carrier,
exactly.
Fairly new, I think only 2 years old, and just right up on the beach. Again, a lot of tourist income from that.
Oh, yeah. I mean, some of these things are, even the MSC Napoli. I mean, she became a tourist attraction, and she still is. She's still also a pain in the neck because her stern's still sitting there. But what's even more amazing is if you look at the casualty reports and you read them, and you look at them and you say, wait a minute, this guy went aground in a gale, and how did he do this? He was hugging the coast. Why? Why would you put your vessel in that type of position, knowing you have heavy weather where your severe wave heights are going to be extreme? Why would you run the coastline? It's the worst place you want to be. So, again, some of these things, you look at them, you just scratch your head and say, how in goodness name can you get yourself in this position?
One of your other hobbies is tornado chasing. So that would be similar to chasing a tornado on a dead-end road.
Even with that hobby, I am continuing this. We just had a recent one in Indiana where sirens go off, funnel cloud is spotted, and what's everybody doing? They run outside with their video cameras, instead of running for shelter. You just sit there and you say, what are you thinking of? And the same thing applies to the industry. And again, it's trouble for saying this, but ship owners have to begin to understand that, hey, listen, number one, you get what you pay for. And if you put a master on who's really not qualified, has limited sea experience, and you're paying him $30,000 a year to pilot a 80,000 deadweight ton bulker or a tanker, well, like I said, you will get what you pay for. But then reporting casualties, again, as you know, John, one of the biggest problems with these casualties is, ship owners have to begin to share information. Shipmasters have to begin to share information. Through lessons learned, will we only as an industry make ourselves better? But a lot of it is, again, as you know, we build these things faster, we can't staff them. And the maritime community is really suffering for experienced people. There's only a few countries that have very good mariners, and then you have everybody else who, gets a master's unlimited, by mail order, because either the registry or the state or the country that is issuing the license has really some substandards to it.
It seems really hit or miss. I mean, some of the countries that are the worst offenders have some of the best mariners, too, but there's just no consistency. You don't know what you're getting, really.
It's like the old saying, you put five engineers in one room, ask them one question, and you get five different answers. And when you put the maritime community together in one room, it's probably time to, after that type of meeting, you go home, take a shower, blow dry your hair with your 45 automatic. The industry has to, the industry has to tighten itself up a little bit more. But the casualties have been extreme. The report, the classification agencies have been throwing out warnings all over there. The underwriters have been throwing out warnings all over the place. I mean, I just take a look at the casualty runs. Like I said, we've had a really good start this year. Just again, like the tornadoes. The United States normally experiences some 1,200 tornadoes a year. So far, since January 1st, we've had close to, almost 500 of them reported. Probably 400 and something confirmed so far, and we're only starting tornado season. So again, it's,
that's before we look overseas. I noticed in the news, the confirmed death count in Burma for a cyclone is 22,000, with estimates as high as 63,000.
It's like we talked before about Burma. I mean, I really feel bad for the folk in Burma. And I have to wonder sometimes why, if the junta. And I knew, of course the junta there knew that storm was coming. You got to wonder whether or not the junta said, "Why, what should we want our people? Let this storm hit, do its damage, and look at the windfall we're going to get." And right now, look at the windfall it's getting. Of course.
Well, you go back to the Pasha Bulker, and there was something like 44 ships in port, and I think six of them decided to stay at anchor. The rest went to sea, and you got to kind of wonder what those six captains were thinking.
Oh, look at what happened up in the Black Sea in February with the Russians. I mean, you put coastwise tankers up in the water there during a major storm, and in one shot you sink five of them, and they knew it was coming in.
So you got a series of problems here. You got a lot of new build, a lot of expansion in the industry, a limited subset of mariners, increased training regulations for these mariners that prevent new people from coming in. You got everyone's strained, from the classification societies, the inspectors. They're all looking for people with experience to perform this, the basic duties. And then you got the weather situation is particularly bad. Questions about global climate warnings, and the number one piece of equipment that can really save the average mariner in any of these situations is the EPIRB. Is that correct?
Exactly, and it's one of the major devices that no matter if you're sailing a ULCC or you're sailing in a 35-foot carver out on the lake somewhere, that is extraordinarily important for life safety. I mean, we just did a weather talk, severe weather talk, brought in Coast Guard out of Michigan City to talk about the maritime problems upon Lake Michigan. And, you know, one of the things that, of course, I said was that, you know, you get all these yachts out and everybody, is buying boats these days, and they throw these radar units on. And then when they get into a weather situation or a rough sea situation, they wonder why, we didn't know what's coming, or they just don't know what they're looking at in the radar. One of the things I said is, you know, you're going to go out and spend, you know, X amount of money to put a radar dome on your boat, and go out and spend some extra bucks in your pocket and go learn to read it. And the same thing with ships. I mean, these collisions that are occurring in fog, even with the anti-collision systems on board, just mind-boggling. Where is your watch? What's somebody doing? Standing at the helm with his eyes closed. It's those types of instances that cause accidents. I mean, same thing in a car. You know, if you're eating while you're driving, or you're watching, if you're down in Florida watching the hot dog babes instead of watching the traffic, you're going to get into an accident. Well, you know, what a 80,000 deadweight ton ship, it's a slightly bigger than your Camaro you're driving. And you know, can cause a tremendous amount of damage and loss of life. So, a lot of this is I hammer on the experience levels and keeping your crews ship shape and trained and getting them into a mode where, you know, when they're off duty, they're in their sacks sleeping to get the proper rest. The other thing that, you know, is that we overlook a lot of these times is the business side. And operations departments and the pencil necks or the bean counters in these companies have to learn, you know, this is just not about money. This is about, not to say that, a ship is not there to make money. Of course it is. Otherwise, it wouldn't be in the business. Fact is that's not the only reason, or that's not the primary reason to be focused on. Of course, you know, expenses or the monetary situation of a ship owner, of course, is a prime concern. But I've got to tell you, you know, if you're going to cut the corners, then you're going to suffer the consequences. And that's, again, historic throughout the industry. But going back to the EPIRB, yeah, it's a very critical life-saving tool. And I think what we're finding on the tip of this iceberg is extremely disturbing.
So bring us to the basics of how you got involved with the Sean Seymour and what the EPIRB problem is. We'll direct any listeners who want to know the bigger story to either listen to that podcast with the rescue team where we go over it, or go to Robin Storm's blog or G Captain. You can read about the full story there. But what specifically about the EPIRB? What happened and what caught your interest?
Well, I got a contact. I had shortly after the incident, contact was made by the vessel owner, the ship's the sailboat's owner, I guess I had spotted the story of the Sean Seymour II and the flying colors, and I blogged about it. And you know, a few days later, I had contact made by the owner of the Sean Seymour II, and that's how I got involved. When I found out the details, I was just not only horrified, but of course I was amazed. This vessel ran into And we're approaching the anniversary date, May 7th, first anniversary date of this incident. This is when subtropical storm Andrew was coming up the coast. And she was being pretty much erratic. And, of course, there were warnings and watches all over the place, but her position, you know, her path was very erratic. So what happened was Sean Seymour, too, at that point, with three on board, was in the Hatteras Trench region off of North Carolina when she got hit with full force of the storm. Her and a couple other boats, one of them was the Flying Colors, which to this day has never been found. The waves, the wave height, the waves generated by the storm were extreme. I'm talking 50, 60, 70, and 80 footers. Winds were somewhere clocking around 75 to 100 miles an hour. And in one case, just as they were attempting to weather the storm, they got broadsided by what the owner calls a freak wave. Of course, freak waves or rogue waves are much different than what a lot of people call, you know, what the media or news outlets call them. A freak or rogue wave is something that's really not explainable. It just happens. Most of these waves can have an explanation. Most of them are due to storms. Anyway, the Sean Seymour, too, got broadsided by a 70-footer and literally 360'd. When that occurred, the G-perb, and I think we need to talk about the difference between the G-perb and the E-perb.
Absolutely.
But the G-perb in question was immediately launched. It failed. It actually transmitted the wrong boat information and the wrong location to the satellite. Luckily for that crew, on the Sean Seymour 2, its master had a second E-perb from an older boat, and he just had it on board. And it accidentally went off when the sailboat 360'd. It sent the wrong boat ID, but sent the actual correct position. And so there was some confusion at that time onto, you know, whose signals were what, and so it delayed the response a little bit. But talk about Coast Guard responses. And then you know the story as well as I do. I mean, talk about dramatic rescues. Coast Guard Elizabeth City launched a C-130, and that crew miraculously found the life raft in question. Called in the Dolphin and H-60 crew, commanded by Lieutenant Commander Nevada Smith, who I think you've had already had podcasted. And he had to hover that helo in 50 to 60 mile an hour winds and launched his rescue swimmer in 50 to 70 foot seas. And of course, the rescue swimmer at one point was injured because he was cresting the waves, he dropped along one side of the wave and his hook actually tagged him and brought him, you know, and he swung back and injured his back, but actually continued the rescue operation, including the recovery of the G-perb. Amazing rescue story. The entire crew, as far as I'm concerned, even though they were decorated, was disappointed that somebody around there didn't get a Distinguished Flying Cross for that operation. I also admit I'm also disappointed in both Senator Hillary Clinton and Senator Barack Obama, because part of that crew, that H-60 crew, came from their state, from their respective states. And of course, as these guys were getting these decorations, word went out to each of the U.S. senators involved covering that crew. And the two that literally did not respond was the two presidential candidates on the Democratic side. Of course, John McCain didn't have anybody involved in that, but it's just amazing that, you know, the United States Coast Guard does one tremendous job and rarely gets her accolades as some of the others in the military do. Not to say that because these guys who are in combat shouldn't get them, they should, but You know, the Coast Guard needs to be recognized a lot more and, of course, funded properly. The mission has increased since 9/11. I think the Department of Homeland Security, or as I know it, the Department of Homeland Stupidity, needs to break both FEMA and the Coast Guard away from it and let them do their merry own gigs. But the Coast Guard itself is doing a tremendous job out there. Anyway, getting back.
I had a weather instructor, and Lee Chesnow, a forecaster with NOAA, and he says you would be amazed at the power of a simple a letter to your congressman, just stating some of these facts. And he says typed email is about the worst form of communication, a handwritten letter. You know, that's true to heart, that's sent to each one handwritten separately to each of your congressmen, senators, asking for the support of the Coast Guard and NOAA forecasting and all that. So a really effective measure.
Exactly. And when one of these guys does something spectacular like Drew Dez or the rescue swimmer involved in this incident, you know, people get on the phone. Call your local representative, but find out who their representatives are. Get on the phone, tell them what happened. Make send them whatever information you can, and yeah, a lot of these guys will respond. And in this case, quite a few of these guys responded. Actually, one of them. I don't remember which ones, I don't want to say, actually was read into the congressional record for his heroism. I mean, these are the things that, even though they sound silly, or why should I go through this for somebody like that, because these guys, you've got to remember, these guys are not making the money we all make. They're risking their lives every day. Anything that they can put in their files that will help them in their careers is extraordinary.
And these are the type of guys that we want growing with the organization and becoming the future admirals and policymakers.
Exactly. I mean, I think we've had enough of flag officers following the or doing the bobblehead routine, and I think we need flag officers there that are not opposed to standing up on their own two feet once in a while, but. This EPIRB issue is still, even a year after this incident occurred, still unresolved. And it's not the only one. September 7th, a vessel named the Papa George, which is a shrimper, was down in Louisiana. Or no, was it Louisiana? Maybe
it
Louisiana.
It was the West Coast.
The West Coast. It was Washington. Ran into some problems and had her EPIRB fail on her. We're still trying to find out why that EPIRB failed. Now, as I said before, you know, the two differences. This was a GPIRB. The other one was, you know, we're talking about EPIRBs. The difference between a GPIRB and an EPIRB is accuracy. The GPIRB is basically mechanism that helps identify its own location. It's operated by GPS. It's hyper accurate. So, unlike an EPIRB, which will rely on the satellite to identify it and where it is, the GPIRB will actually help itself identify to the satellite where it is. Just like the GPS unit in your car, it identifies where you are and then helps the satellite identify where you are. So, and there's not, you know, not that there, you know, there's, of course, there's a cost difference, but the GPIRB is a much better unit, especially when you're out in deep water or out in the major lakes like the Great Lakes, over an EPIRB. An EPIRB, like I said, just operates sends a signal up and tries to get the satellite to identify it. Now there's some
EPIRB emits its signal, it's on a 406 megahertz frequency. It goes up to the satellite. Now, with the traditional EPIRBs, it uses frequency timing to figure out a broad area where it is, and it sends that signal. The signal makes its way to the search and rescue coordination centers. But a GPS sends the same signal, but also encodes GPS signal down to the feet. So the real difference is when the Rescue Coordination Center gets the message, they have to either, if it's a traditional eProbe, they start sending out search grids and have a large area to cover and start searching. If it's a GPS-enabled eProbe, they can send the C-130s or the rescue helicopters directly to the last known position and work from there. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, normally, right, actually, you're absolutely correct. It's a good point to bring up, because the difference between the two units, the GPIRB being hyperactive to help itself against the EPIRB, is because normally what happens is once activated, within a quarter of a second, the EPIRB and GPIRB will start transmitting. It will then transmit once every 50 seconds, and then it will shut down for 20 minutes to conserve its battery power, and then start the process all over again. Now, again, like I said, the difference between the two is the GPIRB will transmit much more data to the satellite in tracking it. And that also allows the Coast Guard not only to locate you, but figure out drift and other parameters so that when they launch your search, if they don't find you in that spot, they already have an idea of where to start the search grid. Again, one of the things that we have to also realize, though, is that these are satellite-operated devices, and weather impacts these things. You have a storm at sea. Storms affect satellite communications. Those folk who have, like, Dish TV will know this, because when you're sitting in front watching your favorite show or soap opera or whatever you're watching, and the local thunderstorm comes across, normally... start throwing things at the television set because you lose your signal. So weather has an impact on signal transmission. Again, the EPIRB will send much more than the EPIRB will.
Now, both also have the capability of a more traditional 121.5. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Rob?
I'm sorry, say that again?
The non-satellite frequency, the 121.5 frequency embedded in the EPIRBs?
Yeah, I believe, and this is where I'm going to get myself into trouble, but I believe that both units transmit on the same frequency.
I can tell a little bit about it. 121.5 is the frequency monitored by most commercial airliners.
Correct.
And the reason for it's embedded in the EPIRB is that the rescue helicopters are able to home in on that beacon. But in order to get the homing, they need to initially be notified by the satellite. So if you're not getting the initial satellite signal, there's going to be no helicopter sent out to home in on you.
This is where I get into a gray area, because that's a yes and no. Again, remember, the GPIRB is a little bit different than the EPIRB in sending transmissions to the satellite. And that's something actually I really need to do is take a look at. I'm not really that much of an EPIRB specialist on the frequency side. It's a good question. And what I will do is I will make some contacts with the Coast Guard or NOAA and get a good understanding of actually how that frequency interplays with both the GPIRB and the EPIRB.
And maybe we can write something up and post in the show notes.
Absolutely. I think it's an important subject, and of course I'm not focused on the frequency at this point, because I am taking a look at the reason why there was a follow-up in the hexadecimal code. And one of the things that we have to explain about this instance is that the GPIRB that malfunctioned didn't malfunction. It operated. What it did do, though, was it transmitted the wrong identifier to the satellite. And each GPIRB and EPIRB has a 15-digit hex code, or hexadecimal code to it. It's supposed to be a very unique code assigned to that specific unit. By law, these things are supposed to be serviced. They're supposed to be updated. You either go to a service company, it depends upon which brand you have, and have them inspect and certify the unit. In this case, something happened here. And what we're trying to get to the bottom of is how one EPIRB got the hexadecimal code to another boat.
So what happens, so the signal gets picked up by the satellites, and this the data from this hexadecimal code is what you registered when you registered with NOAA. Is that correct?
So that's correct.
The first thing that's going to happen is that NOAA is going to check its database for that code, and what are they going to see on their screen? Just your contact information?
Yeah, they'll get confirmation on vessel ownership, type of vessel. They'll start getting position coordinates. And with a GPIRB, they'll even get a little bit more data, and all of a sudden that's immediately relayed over to the SAR guys at Coast Guard or whatever agencies are responding. The interesting point about this is no matter where that GPIRB or EPIRB is bought, there is only one agency on the actually controls the satellite, and that's NOAA. That's the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. The GPIRB or EPIRB in England, and when you register it, it's going to have a NOAA decal on it because NOAA controls the satellite. So once that data gets – I'm sorry?
Now, once they get the data, they're going to transmit it to the Coast Guard, obviously, but they're also going to call you. And I take it that was part of the problem here. They called the wrong person?
Yeah, what happens is once that data gets transmitted over, they start to verify to make sure it's not a false flag. What happened was Coast Guard reached out and called the boat owner. And I don't know where the boat owner exactly is in Alabama, but I'm sure I can tell you one thing. He sure wasn't at sea. I don't know if he was out doing a barbecue or chugging a few, but he was not at sea. And the boat that it identified was, I believe, sitting in his backyard or on his driveway somewhere. That's when the second signal occurred, which transmitted the signal from the Lupata. The Lupita was the vessel prior to the Sean Seymour II that Jean-Pierre Deloutte's owned. So, and that one, like I said, was activated accidentally when the boat did the 360. It transmitted the identifier to the right person, wrong boat name, right party, and transmitted the proper location. That was an EPIRB, not the GPIRB. So what happened was Coast Guard then zeroed in on that signal and found the right vessel owner and then launched her rescue operations. That is the reason why the original response wasn't to the Sean Seymour II, but to the sailing vessel Lupita. And that just added to the confusion. And that got all wrapped up after, when that started to get cleared up after the rescue occurred. What boat was what boat? The bigger question, like I said again, was the GPIRB and how this hexadecimal code got followed up to a point where it transmitted the wrong identifier, even though the label on that EPIRB on the GPIRB is correct. But
so if you buy a used EPIRB, or if you buy a used boat, or you borrow an EPIRB from the friend, you want to make sure it has your contact information. So when the Coast Guard NOAA's actually going to call you to see if you're okay, and you don't want the person they're calling saying, "Yeah, I'm okay," and the rescue being canceled.
Once you register this, once you register the GPIRB or the EPIRB. Or that you have the service company do it, and it checks and verifies this because you have to certify that the GPIRB or EPIRB is operational. That service company is supposed to certify to you that, number one, the GPERB hexadecimal code is correct, you're the owner, and it functions, and the battery life is good. In this case, supposedly, the service company that did the work apparently certified this thing, but it transmitted the wrong information. Now, there's only a couple of ways this could have happened, in my opinion. And now I'm going to shoot from my hip because we're still trying to ascertain fact. But there's only a couple ways of doing this. Either the registration originally was filed up, and if that is the case, then the hexadecimal code on that GPERB should not match the Sean Seymour 2, but it does. Or somehow, during the servicing, the guts of one GPERB was guts of a GPERB, and it transmitted the signal that it was designed to transmit, and not the hexadecimal code that of the Sean Seymour 2. Again, I'm going to be careful here and surmise this is the two causes, the basis of fact, but there's only, I mean, there's not any, or I should say there's a third way that could have done, was that there was a manual input into the database by NOAA that was wrong. That's happened before. But at this point, we still need to ascertain really what happened here. The big problem here is that this is not the first time, and this is not a rarity where GPERBs and EPERBs fail. And that's the problem. This needs to be we need to take a very hard look at why this is occurring. This is a critical life safety device. For whatever reason it fails, why they are failing, whether it's antenna problems, whether water gets into the enclosure, whether there's a follow-up in the application, or the service company does something stupid and does something wrong, because we're not playing with duct tape here. We're playing with human life. It's one thing on a vessel. You lose the vessel. Idea is, the vessel you can always recover or salvage or write it off as a loss. I have yet to find out how any insurance company salvages a dead body, or how a family salvages a dead body. And so these devices are critical. And if we're going to have regulations that saying you're going to have this thing in your boat or your ship, and these are the regulations for operating, we have to have a way of ensuring that these things are checked, but checked as they're supposed to be.
So,
in the meantime,
so being
EPERB individual owner needs not to rely on a service company. You got to do a check yourself. I mean, as we talked about before.
Well, this is
call NOAA or ComSat down in Baltimore, or in Maryland, and you identify yourself as the EPERB owner and you give them the hexadecimal code, check. Let them run the database. And as we know, even if you're not the owner of the EPERB or GPERB, you may not be able to go on the website and log in, but you can call NOAA, and you can ask them to run explain the situation. This is what I'm doing. This is a friend's GPERB, or I'm going out on his boat. Does it work? And they will run the hexadecimal code to ensure that, the registration is right. That doesn't necessarily mean, though, that the unit's right, that the unit works. And it's not like, you can test these things by turning them on and off, because if you did that, you will drive everybody wild.
So I think if we can have people take one thing away from this podcast and do just one thing, obviously it's not enough to ensure your safety, but it's call NOAA and give them the hexadecimal code that's printed on the side of your EPERB. If you're the vessel owner, you can do it on the website, but if you're just a crew member or going to a friend's boat or something like that, call NOAA, give them that hexadecimal code, and their phone number is 301 301-817-4515. Again, that's 301-817-4515. And it's the same number whether you're in Singapore and bought a EPIRB locally there, or you're bought one down the street from NOAA's headquarters. Everyone has that same number to call. It's in the U.S., so it's country code 1.
And I think that it's important to mention that, you know, don't wait to check your GPIRB, EPIRB. Do it now. Don't wait until you go out and you're out in the middle of the water or you're getting ready to go. Do it now. Even though you may have a certified unit, do it anyway. And again, like I said, there's a lot more material on GPIRBs and EPIRBs, stuff that we haven't even bothered to cover because it would take 3 days to go over. But I think, and I know John and I feel the same way, if anyone who's listening to this e-podcast has ever experienced a problem with a GPIRB or EPIRB malfunction or mistransmission, please contact GCAPTAIN. Let us know about it. It's important we know of any other problems with these devices. And I will tell you this much. I've already been in touch with the House Coast Guard Subcommittee on this issue. I would like to see if we can give them enough data to take a serious look into whether or not hearings need to be held on this type of life safety equipment.
And our contact information, our email is podcast@messingaboutinships.com. And I'm also going to give you my personal phone number here, which you can contact me. I think this issue is that important. 805-456-8611.
And yeah, do it about 3 o'clock in the morning when and heavy breathing while you're no.
It's not that critical. It can wait till California time zone.
You don't sleep anyway, John. Anyway, what are you talking about?
Yeah. I wanted to bring up one other small issue here, and yeah. I think it's important. The fact of redundancy is what really saved Gene. He had two EPIRBs on board. One was in a hydrostatic release, and I can't state how important it is. You may not be able to get that EPIRB on time.
Exactly.
There was a San Francisco businessman who went out on his boat and was lost. They still haven't found him. He kept his EPIRB in a cabinet down below. It never went off, and assumptions are made he might not have been able to get to it on time. So one should be mounted so it automatically releases when your vessel sinks in case you can't get to it in time. And then it's good to have a second system. In addition to GPIRBs and EPIRBs, there are ELTs. That's what aircraft carry. But there are also things called a PLB, and this is a personal locator beacon. You can buy them as cheap as $400 U.S., and this is one that you can clip to your belt. Not only can you take it on the boat with you or clip it to your life jacket, you can take it out hiking if you're into outdoor sports. And some of these have, again, you want to look for the GPS capabilities. They run a few hundred dollars more, around $600. That's another option. But it's critical. You don't want to put all your eggs in one basket, just have one unit on board. That seems like a recipe for disaster with me.
Yeah, they have what they call them MOBs, man overboard wristwatches, that can also transmit the signal. And as you said, you know, some of these devices are excellent when you're out in the wilderness. Those of you who do the Appalachian Trail, the watches, I think, believe are put out by Citizens or one of them. I don't remember the manufacturer. They are pricey, but I'll tell you what. In the middle of nowhere in the wilderness, and you get into trouble, that signal watch would come in a nick of time, especially if you can't get a cell signal.
Yeah, there's one great one that Captain Richard Rodriguez of the Bitter End blog is carrying on his boat right now. It's the Spot Personal Tracker. And again, we do not recommend this as a replacement for an eProbe. You still need an eProbe. This is just additional. But it uses a different satellite system. It's got a 911 button on it that you press, and it's just another piece of equipment you have. This one has the added neat feature where your family can log into a website and actually follow you on a Google map. Again,
and if you're cheating on your wife, I wouldn't be wearing those things.
$149 if you take a ferry often, or you're going on a cruise ship. It might be worth having.
Yeah, one of the other tricks, John. For those folk or family members who are in local waters, even your cell phone. Go into the systems archive of your cell phone. Go into locations and turn on the GPS unit to always, and what will happen is you if you get into a problem and you hit 911 or any problem, your phone is immediately being tracked. That's just a small trick with the cell phone. If you're getting close enough where you're out playing on a lake or something and you got a cell signal, you have cell signals, just go in and put your locator on always, and your cell phone will begin to transmit your location. That's just a small trick. Of course, if you're out in the middle of the Atlantic or the Pacific, you're a ship out of luck.
Yeah, and redundancy seems key. Make sure you have two systems.
Redundancy at sea and when you're out boating is never a bad idea. And then again, as we've talked before, if you're going to go out and play with ships and boats, be responsible. It's just not a party craft. Become responsible. If you come up to Chicago during the summer, you'll get to see some of the most irresponsible things you've ever seen off Ohio Beach. So, again, you got to remember, not only do you have your life in your hands, you have other people's lives in your hands as the captain of a small boat or yacht. And if you're a master of a ship, you all too well know your legal responsibilities.
The buck really stops there.
Exactly. And hopefully the buck won't stop in some federal penitentiary.
Yeah, it's happening more and more often.
Exactly. So all ships officers, you need not only worry about your vessel and your crew, but you need to worry about your legal responsibilities as a ship's officer. Something that many in the industry do and many don't.
All right. Thank you very much, Rob. So we want to encourage everyone to call NOAA, 301-817-4515. Verify your hexadecimal code. Make sure you have at least two EPIRBs on board. If you're questioning your ship, bring your own PLB, personal locator beacon. If it's too expensive for you, try one of these spot satellite personal messengers, or simply activate the GPS on your cell phone if you're staying within cell phone range. And otherwise, make sure your equipment's in really good working order, that the hydrostatic release works, the internal checks go out, and if the equipment looks bad, it probably is. You have any final comments before we wrap up, Rob?
No, while you're checking your EPIRB, your GPIRB, make sure that every other flotation device you have is working. Make sure that your depth finders and your radar are working and you understand how they work. Just be safe. And John, I want to thank you very much for doing this. G-Captain provides a great service to the community, and I think that you're becoming quite a beacon for the industry. I want to thank you very much.
Oh, thank you, Rob. You definitely help support us along the way. Couldn't do it without the great stories you keep sending us. So.
Yeah, I'm a troublemaker at heart.
All right, that concludes this special segment, and please continue listening to the podcast. Share it with your friends. Take care.
Welcome back to the podcast. We really thank Rob for coming on board with us. So I think what we really, the important things to take away, Peter, are that you want redundancy, you want more than one type of positioning, whether it just be turning on the GPS in your cell phone if you're in range, or buying a second EPIRB and maybe one of these personal locator beacons or the spot messengers, checking your equipment, and then making sure that the registration code on your EPIRB matches the data in NOAA's database. And we provided the phone number for you to call. That's the best way. Call NOAA up, give them your registration code, and they'll read off there your information. Make sure it's accurate and correct. It's the most important piece of safety equipment on your vessel, electronic equipment. So it's really important.
Great. Well, that's good information. Thank you and Rob for that segment. Jumping into our internet ports of call this week, what do you got?
All right, this week I have the Holland & Knight newsletter. It's a daily newsletter that comes every morning, and their focus is really regulatory issues. They're based out of Washington, and they talk about regulatory, mainly U.S.-based issues in the maritime industry. They go into some news items, but it's just a good morning wake up, a cup of coffee, read over their newsletter, and just see what's happening in Washington and with the IMO and some of the regulatory bodies. And it's free, which is always nice.
Yeah, there's always great information in there, and I get that every morning myself, and check it out. So it's definitely worth a read. And I mentioned earlier in the podcast that blog.org, an unofficial coast, they cited Christian Conover's blog as one of their finds last week. So Christian had a good week between participating with us and then being identified with them. Hopefully get some good traffic over in his blog. But the cgblog.org, unofficial Coast Guard blog, I think is well known to you, John, right?
Done some stories together in the past. April Fool's, we shared an April Fool's joke as well.
Yeah, I think you were, there was a report that you had taken them over, I think. Was it hostile takeover or was it a friendly takeover?
It began as friendly. It turned a bit hostile as the negotiations continued. You can go back in their archives around April 1st and read a little bit about it. I think after the takeover, they are moving to Bolivia to cover the Bolivian Coast Guard.
That's right. That isn't necessarily a good thing. But anyway, these guys' commentary, opinion, and news about the nation's smallest military service, the United States Coast Guard, a multi-mission maritime armed force. Unofficial, totally. Yeah, I mean, these guys are covering what the Coast Guard policies, activities, some good opinions in there, always interesting writing, and I just find it fascinating that they're actually doing this right now as you know, being active in the Coast Guard, and I think they've been discussing pretty openly in the blog as well that Coast Guard's looking at, I think, blogging policy, right? You've actually written about that. I think you had something about even the Coast Guard's interest in maybe editing comments, or what was that all about, John?
Well, they haven't decided policy yet, but one of the admirals was discussing, and everything from total ban of both bloggers' posts and commenters' posts. So any active duty person who's even commenting on a blog like G-Captain or C-Fever could be restricted. Hopefully it doesn't get that far, but it's something to watch out for.
Interesting. Well, it's check it out, cgblog.org. We'll have a link in the show notes. And I think it's definitely something worth checking out every day. So do you have anything else, John?
No, that wraps up this week. How about you, Peter?
No, I guess just to remind people that they can get a hold of us in a lot of different ways through the blog, which is messingaboutinships.com. Leave a comment there, and we'll be sure to read it or answer any questions you have. You can send us an email at podcast@messingaboutinships.com. You can get John over at gcaptain.com. You can get me at seafever.org, and that's SEA-FEVER.org. And then finally, you can get us via Skype, which is our Skype address is MAIS Podcast. And what's the Skype number, John? Do you remember that?
206-973-7000. So that's country code 1, and then 206-973-7000.
Don't forget to put yourself on that listener chart, too. We're always looking forward to hearing from everybody.
Quickly, too, I put a little video explaining the different types of EPIRB. By the time you hear this, it should be posted on G-Captain. So take a look for that. It's a little graphical interface to this discussion.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, you have another good week, and I will talk to you next week.
All right. Thanks a lot, Peter. See you then.
This week's music comes from the band Nine Inch Nails, and they released an album via their website, which is nin.com. It's free. It's totally free. And Trent Reznor writes here, thank you for your continued and loyal support over the years. This one's on me. So the album is actually called A Slip, and the song we're going to play for you is called Lights in the Sky. Hope you enjoy it.
Trying to stay.